They're like, you know, little parrots. They repeat what you say, so be careful what you say around them. Chapter 17, Matthew's Gospel. This is in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. If you want to see a dividing line in the Gospel, this is it. This event. Jesus backs away from the crowds. We're not talking about the crowds as much anymore. And he begins focusing on his disciples. And it all culminates at a place that we're going to talk about in a few moments called Caesarea Philippi. Things change. And Jesus' ministry changes. His focus begins looking toward Jerusalem. And you will find that even in Luke's gospel, Jesus sets his face to go to Jerusalem. Now that's not a geographical journey like he's going in a straight line. But the idea is he is moving toward Jerusalem for the culmination of what he is upon this earth to do. Matthew is going to also include this in chapter 16. In Mark, it's in chapter 8, where you see that dividing line take place. Jesus has dealt with rejection in his hometown, the rejection of the Jews themselves, rejection of the Jewish leadership. He turned and we saw a bright freshness of reaching out to the Gentiles with even the feeding of the 4,000 and the Syrophoenician woman that he healed her daughter. But now we're going to be moving in to, did I say chapter 17? I mean 16. Okay, 16. You all looking ahead. I guess I was thinking ahead too. All right, so with that mentioned, kind of a brief introduction, let's move right into verse 1, chapter 16. The Pharisees and the Sadducees came up, and testing Jesus, they asked him to show them a sign from heaven. And I'm going to park right there because this is phenomenal. Because you have two religious groups that did not agree, did not get along. You had the Pharisees and Sadducees. The Sadducees were a much smaller group, but they were more like the ruling class. The high priest was always, in this period of history, the high priest was a Sadducee. The Sadducees did not believe in spirits. They did not believe in angels or demons. All they believed in is we had this shot upon the earth and that was it. So they did not believe in the resurrection either. They did not look at life after death. Smaller group, but nevertheless, that's some of the positions that they held. Also, they were more favorably looked upon by the Roman government, the Roman authorities. The Pharisees, larger group, but less powerful as far as economically or politically. But they would hold on to some of the beliefs that the Sadducees had rejected. They believed in angels and demons. They believed in life after death. They believed in the resurrection of the dead. It's almost, they were very similar in belief of what you would find in the New Testament. Believers. With the exception of their, well, one primary thing would be their self-righteousness. Believing that they were, because of their efforts, really something that God was blessed to have them on their team. And they clashed with Jesus over the tradition of the elders. Primarily those things that were associated with the Sabbath day. There were others. And he's going to encounter them later. Now in chapter 15, we found that some of these Pharisees and scribes came from Jerusalem. They traveled up to where Jesus was in Galilee and confronted him there. Now we have these two groups that don't get along, joined together with one purpose. What's that purpose? Get rid of Jesus. That they saw in Jesus a common threat. So the two groups had united together in order to do that. And they asked him, show them a sign from heaven. Now, it's interesting that this is the request. It reveals something about them. Do you think that they either heard of or maybe some had even witnessed some of the miracles that Jesus performed? Most likely. Most likely. At least some of them would have had that opportunity. Had they heard his teaching? Undoubtedly, yes. At least some of them had. And they had come on different occasions to confront Jesus and try to confuse him, so to speak, as they had other religious opponents. Now, nevertheless, here they are, and they want Jesus to perform. Show us a sign. Well, have they not been paying attention? It indicates that their desire really wasn't to see Jesus perform a miracle. There are plenty of opportunities to explore those kind of events. It's a test. It's a test. They're wanting to somehow paint Jesus into a corner. They do that they do that several times. They fail every time. So Jesus' response is very telling. But he replied to them, "When it is evening, you say it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, there will be a storm today, for the sky is red and threatening." Kind of like the old adage, you know, red sky at morning, sailor take warning. Red sky at night, sailor's delight. Jesus is pointing to that. He says, "Do you know how to discern the appearance of the sky, but cannot discern the signs of the times?" You can tell those kind of things, but here you're not getting the signs of the times. So Jesus follows up, and now this is, I think, a very important verse that is often neglected. "An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and a sign will not be given to it except the sign of Jonah. And he left them, and he went away." So Jesus is not going to perform for them per their request. He's just not going to do that. As a matter of fact, the miracles that Jesus performed were never for the purpose of showing off or anything like that. They had a much deeper purpose. Nevertheless, at this point, that was their intent. But Jesus in verse 4 points out something. Yes, he's talking to that specific group of people at that specific time. And he simply affirms, "An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign." In the 1990s, I don't know if you've noticed that there's trends in Christianity. I mean, there are trends. What becomes hot, what becomes where you can get all the books and you get all the seminars, you get all the sermons and all that kind of stuff. There'll be a trend, and you can watch it. If you went back to the probably the early 1970s and into the 1970s, you may remember that there was one of the trends of those days was prophecy everywhere. The late great Planet Earth kind of culminated that and just pushed that out, and you heard a lot about it. You move into the 80s. What was the trend? Well, the trend was Willow Creek Community Church, the Paradigm Church. This is how churches reach people. This is how churches grow. This is how church does what a church is supposed to be. You no longer worship for the sake of the people on Sunday. What you do is you become seeker-focused. And then a little bit later in the 80s, another church came to prominence, and a pastor of that church became to prominence. And this one, though, wasn't in Chicago. It was in Southern California, in Orange County, named Saddleback. And Rick Warren came along, "Oh, no, 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 you don't need to be seeker-focused. You need to be seeker-sensitive." And they had a diagram made up by Unchurched Harry and Unchurched Mary, these characteristics. And you needed to follow those kind of things, so... that was the paradigm. And so that you saw that trend. When you get into the 1990s, I don't know if you're aware of some of this thing. Another church in California made a big splash. And a former Righteous Brother member named John Wimber come to the forefront. Now, this particular movement was different. It was called Third Wave of the Holy Spirit. It was interesting, though, this particular group was quite different than some previous groups. Really, one of the major things was they believed in signs and wonders, and they perpetuated that belief. And if you went to any of their meetings, it was the denomination that they started was called the Vineyard. And there was one at one time in South St. Louis. So I actually went to see what was going on at the Vineyard. And the interesting thing about the the Vineyard movement is theologically, they were very Baptistic, with the exception of signs and wonders. They did not believe in the second blessing of the Holy Spirit like Pentecostals do, or assembly do. They did not believe in that, but they did believe in the operation of the gifts of the Spirit, even those gifts that were considered the sign gifts, primarily signs and wonders, healings, that kind of thing. Within that group, there was a lot of people that eventually became part of that. Interestingly enough, very highly educated folks. The Pentecostal movement, I'm not trying to say anything derogatory other than just making an observation. More than half of my family is Pentecostal. However, they seemingly were people who were just common, everyday kind of folk would be kind of swept up into Pentecostalism. But the Vineyard had people that had PhDs, seminary professors. One particular professor that was somewhat noteworthy was a man named Jack Deere. He was the Old Testament professor at Dallas Theological Seminary. And actually, I wrote letters to some of these people, and they responded back because I was curious. One fellow that was wrote a book that was really quite interesting to me at the time, and it was a man named Dr. John White. And he wrote a book called When the Spirit Comes with Power. I would still recommend that book. The thing about Dr. White is not only was he prolific, he wrote a lot of books. He was a psychiatrist. Now, anybody know the difference between a psychiatrist and a psychologist?
Oh, yeah.
A psychiatrist is a medical doctor. And Dr. White was a medical doctor. And I remember some of the things he told. He talked about going to some areas. I think it was, I don't remember what country it was, but it was outside the United States, where he is. Now, remember, he's a medical doctor. And he's talking about praying for people, and he could actually feel the bones moving under his hands. Now, he also was mentioned in a book that Jack Deere wrote called Surprised by the Spirit. And I wrote to Dr. White asking him, were the accounts that Deere was talking about, were they true, or would he fabricate them? Because White was involved in these things. And I had to send it to his publisher, who forwarded it on to him, and he wrote me back, and he said, and he confirmed that yes, they are. So there was that movement. The problem with that movement is it became fixated on signs and wonders. And as time went on, there was another. This was a revival, one of those pocket revival where people were coming from all over the world to go to. And it was at the Airport Vineyard in Toronto, Canada. John Arnott was the pastor there. And actually, he was in St. Louis. Kind of, you had to call and find out where and when, and you could go meet him, because he's going to talk about the revival service there. So I went and listened to him, talked to him, whatnot. Now, the Airport Vineyard, things began to go wild. Because once you set a path that these things are becoming the core of your ministry, some really bizarre things began happening in the Airport Vineyard. They began talking about being drunk in the Spirit. And what they were saying was, and this is where the movement began to splinter. Because other pastors and other churches were leaving the Vineyard because they did not want to be associated with this kind of thing that was happening there. And he was talking about being drunk in the Spirit. And what he was saying to us is that if the Spirit came upon you, the Holy Spirit, during one of their church services, what would happen would be you would mimic an intoxicated man. You'd become Otis Campbell, you know, slurring and staggering and all that kind of stuff. And there were people doing that kind of thing. And then they would justify that by going to Acts 2 and saying by the word of the critics, oh, they're full of new wine. discounting what was happening on the day of Pentecost. And they were using that as a proof text. That just didn't work, because when you come into the book of Ephesians, Paul says, do not be filled with wine in which there's debauchery, but be filled with the Spirit. He makes a contrast there. Now, I know he's talking about drinking alcoholic beverages and becoming drunk. I know that. But to equate those things together, there was a problem there. It went on, and I won't get into all the details, but what ended up happening was there were manifestations going on at the Airport Vineyard that even the vineyard churches that were left in their association voted them out, because they were doing things like roaring in the Spirit, making animal noises, or acting like a raging bull, you know, snorting and carrying on. And John Wimber, when he was still living at that time, he had made the comment, in Anaheim, with the church that we started there, the Anaheim Vineyard, we would have tried to cast demons out of those people and not blame it on the Holy Spirit. So things begin to fracture. John White, matter of factly, in his book, that When the Spirit Comes with Power, he pointed out that the danger that lie ahead for the Vineyard movement was going to be that very thing. Now we live in a day which the Vineyard has now, they're off, but you still have the signs and wonders people. And you need to understand something. When I'm making statements like this, I am not suggesting that God does not still heal. I am not suggesting that God does not supernaturally intervene with miracles or signs. What I am wanting to emphasize, that when a person, an individual Christian, or a group make that the main focus of their ministry and of their life, they are going to go off the rails. Because Jesus is suggesting something here I think we need to pay close attention to. So whether you're talking about Benny Hinn or Clefo Dollar or whomever else you want to throw in the mix, need to be careful when those individuals begin focusing on signs and wonders. Because notice the warning of Jesus? An unfaithful generation. We use the word the adulterous. An unfaithful generation seeks after a sign. And Jesus is not going to play that game. He's not going to play it here. He's not going to play it before Herod either. When Herod wants to see him do a trick, Jesus doesn't even answer and refuses to even do anything at all. We need to kind of keep that in mind. I hope I didn't give you too long an oration there. But when we go to verse 5, the paragraph shifts. He's went away. He had departed from there. Verse 5, and the disciples came to the other side. Obviously, when it says the other side, we're talking about the other side of the sea. But they had forgotten to bring any bread. And Jesus said to them, watch out and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So Jesus warns them. He's really using a teachable moment. He realizes that the disciples were responsible to bring along some sandwiches, and they didn't do it. Maybe they got all wound up in what was going on before and forgot to do that. And they began to discuss among themselves, verse 7 tells us, that because we did not bring bread. But Jesus, aware of this, said, you men of little faith, why do you discuss among yourselves that you have no bread? Do you not yet understand or remember the 5 loaves and the 5,000, how many basketfuls you picked up? Or the 7 loaves and the 4,000, and how many large baskets full you picked up? How is it that you do not understand that I did not speak to you concerning bread, but beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees? Then they understood that he did not say, beware of the leaven of bread, but of the teaching or the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Be aware. Be aware. You probably don't need me to say much on this, especially you all being here on a Wednesday night. But you do need to be careful about what you are taking in and what you are embracing when it comes to the various teachings that you hear about today. You need to be careful about some of those. And you need to be able to evaluate whether there is truth in there, or is it something that you keep the meat and you spit out the bones? There may be details that you don't agree with for various reasons. Or is a teaching have a falsehood about it? Or will it be a threshold into something else? There's some phraseology. The first time, I heard it among certain groups, but I heard Johnny Hunt once say it before he was disgraced. Johnny Hunt said something that really bugged me. Now, I will admit, it may be Andy. That's the problem, okay? I am not, but he was talking about speaking truth into people's lives. Something about that phrase bugged me. Not the exact words or maybe what it was meant by it, but just the way he phrased it. Speaking truth into it sounded kind of authoritarian to me. I don't know. Again, I'm not going to take it further than I need to, but there's something about that just didn't. I don't want to use that phrase. And again, that could just be me. But anyway, you need to be careful. Usually you're careful about what you eat. If you open a refrigerator and then you look at your, going to make a bologna sandwich, and you notice that, the bologna's slimy, you probably ought not make your sandwich. So you probably don't eat that up. Eat it. Or if you look there and you pull out an apple and you had to notice that it looks kind of funny and it's kind of soft and your finger kind of goes in one side. It may not be something you need to sit down and eat, right?
Hey, what do you
do? Well, normal people, okay? You understand what I'm saying? We need to be careful about spiritually what we will take into ourselves, because it will make a difference. And just because something is kind of fashionable doesn't mean that it's right or it's correct or it's biblical. And we need to be, I think, aware of that. And there's more of it today, probably, at least it's more accessible today than it ever has been in history. It's everywhere. It's just simply everywhere. It doesn't matter it doesn't even matter what denomination we're talking about. I know of, and I could give names of Southern Baptist prominent people are saying things that, quite frankly, are wrong. Is that my opinion? Well, yeah, that's my opinion, but I think I've got a leg to stand on when I say that. Because some of the things that they're implying is simply wrong. You cannot bring in Marxist language into the gospel. You can't do that, because the two systems are totally opposed. Now, I'm talking about critical race theory, or critical theory first, and then intersectionality. We cannot bring that, we cannot import that stuff into what we call the gospel. We need to be aware of that. And we have some of our leaders have actually done that and are doing that. And that's just one example. There are other things too. The big thing now is not necessarily going to be a CRT. The big thing now is called Side B theology. Well, you didn't know there was a Side A, did you? What is Side B theology? It's the gay Christian. It's being ushered in. It is an oxymoron. Actually, it's worse than that. It's a downright contradiction. Because when you start putting adjectives in front of the word Christian, you've got a problem. Well, here's the gossiping Christian. Here is the adulterer Christian. Here is the liar Christian. Here's the embezzler. You know, anytime you start doing that, you see what it does. Now, the thing of it is, and I can name some of very prominent SBC people, at least they were prominent SBC people, have been open to this. Ed Stetzer, you may not recognize the name, but he was a very, at one time, a big wig in Southern Baptist life. He's been a proponent of Sidley theology, or the third way, for years. I remember the first time he had a same-sex attracted pastor on his radio program. And he followed right along with it. You know, okay. What happens, though, is what happened to the Methodist Church. I don't know if you heard about what they've done. They've totally done away with the idea that they can ordain and celebrate gay clergy. You know, no problem at all. Okay, so that's probably enough of that oration. I've kind of went off on two different stumps to stand on for a while. Here we're getting to the shift. It's the first time that we have a record that Jesus actually proposes a question to his disciples other than, are you so dense you can't get this? It has to do with, who is Jesus? This takes place, I'm going to show you where it took place at, and I want to explain a little bit about this place. Assuming that this will work. It's in northern Israel, about 25 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. This thing takes a minute to warm up. There we go. That's not the place. This is the place, Caesarea Philippi. It was named after Caesar by Herod. It was a community. Now, what we're going to be looking at is not the town of Caesarea Philippi or the ruins of Caesarea Philippi, but we're going to be looking at what made Caesarea Philippi noteworthy. Jesus took his disciples. They went north, again, about 25 miles to this place. And it's here that Jesus asked this question. Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And they said, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, still others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. And he said to them, but who do you say that I am? Simon Peter answered, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now, this is very important. There at Caesarea Philippi, why did Jesus take his disciples here? Well, if you wanted to find the most pagan place in ancient Israel, this is where you would go. At the Temple of Pan. I'll show you more about that in just a moment. Well, I'll go to the next picture. That is what Pan, in their mythology, looked like. Half man, half goat, and yes, a god. And you notice there in his right hand a flute. He was one that would, in the Greek mythology, he would go, he would play that, and he would mesmerize women. I mean, they would hear the music, and they would be drawn to this very grotesque creature. His feet, if you notice right here, you see a hoof. So we're talking from the waist down, a goat. And then, of course, he had horns, and his face was goat-like. They would be just drawn. He would have a way of just kind of mesmerizing them. And they would come, and then when they would come to their senses, they would panic. because of what place? Dedicated totally to his worship. Now, as you approach it, this is a spring. And you can see there a cave. Now, the cave has collapsed. It is not as big or as open as it was at the time of Jesus. Now, that particular cave had a name. It was the gates of hell. You need to know that. That's what they thought. They called it, literally, as the gates of Hades. The gates of hell is really a mistranslation. It's the gates of Hades. Hades is a place of the dead. So it was believed that what would happen there, that cave, where the water's coming out of that spring, if you were able to go far enough, you would actually go to the nether world, where the dead go when they die. And that was what it was thought to do. They would actually sacrifice animals, primarily goats, of course, and they would put them back into that cave as sacrifices. Now, the worship of Pan that would take place, you don't see it here, but when another photograph, you'll see a little bit closer. You'll notice that you see all these carvings into the side of the bluff. Those there were made and images of Pan and other gods were put there. And you can see, and you can see they still look pretty good. You can see several of those that you'll see around in that area. And those niches are all over. I can't remember how many of them there were, but there's a good number. And you'll see other aspects of it. There's ruins around as you're getting up to it. You can see how large an outcropping of the bluff. That's what I call those. Those rocks are that bluff. You see how the outcropping of them there. And you can see that it was kind of a pretty place. But it was also a place of some of the most pagan-type worship anywhere in the ancient world. It was very, very... Yeah, it's terror standing by some of the... You see some of the stones that are still there in that area. And one of the pillars that was there. So it was a very ornate place. It was a very beautiful place. It was a very tranquil scene of where it was located because it's outside of actually any kind of living area. And it was known to be some of the most immoral, orgy, sexual kinds of worship you could beyond what you probably can imagine, took place right there. It was a very wicked place. As a matter of fact, you would not find a more wicked place in that region. Now that's interesting to me. Why is it interesting? I would imagine that the disciples are thinking to themselves, what are we doing here? Now, I don't know exactly where Jesus and his disciples went. I don't know if... I doubt if they went down into that area of that worship. But that's going to help fill in the gaps, what you just seen, of what comes now. Okay? And Jesus, you know, remember the question was asked, who do people say that the Son of Man is? Who they say I am? And some said this, some said that, Jeremiah, one of the prophets, John the Baptist. And then Jesus asked specifically, who do you say? Now this is very key. Even though I know he did not fully understand it, or I suspect he didn't, Peter's response was, you are the Christ, first, the Son of the living God. Okay? So first, you are the Messiah, but he couples it with another statement, another title. You are the Son of God, of the living God. That's profound. Somewhere along the way, Peter's starting to connect the dots. And I imagine the other disciples are as well. Probably with the exclusion of Judas, but the others. You remember he walked on the water? And after that, they were really stunned. And I showed you that in Job chapter 9, that it is God who walks on the waves of the water. So when they saw him doing that and realized he is not a ghost, the conclusion is, according to what the Bible says, he must be the Son of God. So Peter, he says that here. He follows up with that. And then Jesus commends him. Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jona. The word bar in Hebrew means son. You ever heard of a bar mitzvah? It's when a young man becomes a son of the law. Bar. So when you see that, Bar-Jona or Bar-John. Because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who's in heaven. Okay? So Jesus commends what Peter says. I also say to you that you are Peter. And upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overpower it. Okay? Again, remember where they are. Okay? Jesus took them there so they would be able to visually connect the words that he's saying to them and not just do it mentally. They'd be able to see concretely what he's talking about. All right, Peter. You're Peter. Now, the Peter's name, or the word Peter in Greek, is Petros. Okay, that's masculine. Greek is an inflected language, meaning that gender is attached to nouns. I say that Spanish is too. You know, it's a gendered language, so the nouns will, especially the pronouns and people's names, will reflect gender, male or female, or neuter, depending on what we're talking about. So you're Peter, and Petros means rocks, pebbles. It's similar where I grew up. It's not like this right here, but where I grew up, we had no shortage of rocks. Matter of fact, where our cows made paths down on the hillsides, there would be piles of flint rocks that would pile up there as the weight of the cow would kind of push them out to the side. That's what we're talking about, rocks. Kind of like going out here in this flower bed, it's just a bunch of rocks. That's Peter, and it's masculine. All right? Then Jesus shifts, and upon this rock. Now this rock is not Petros. It's Petra. Petra is a feminine word. To be quite frank about it, the Catholic religion rests on this passage. It rests on this passage. And if this passage, if they're misinterpreting it, they've based themselves on simply what's not true. And I will submit to you they have missed it. Number one, Peter's not the first pope. Because Jesus is not talking about Peter. Because he's using two different words. Remember what Peter means? You know, we call him rocky. There's a bunch of gravel kind of rocks, small rocks. Petra is a massive rock. It's not a small rock. It's massive. Where are they? Well, they're at Caesarea Philippi. Peter's made this profession. Jesus is telling them, you're Peter. You're a small rock. But upon this, what's there in front of them? Do you see how big that was? How that hillside is a big bluff there, cliff. That's what he says when he moves on. And he says, and upon this rock I will, future tense, I will build my church. First use of the word church in Matthew. And the gates of Hades will not overpower it. Where are they? That's where they are. If you kind of think along with me and imagine along with me as best you can, you don't have to imagine the graphic part necessarily. But here's Jesus. He takes his disciples. He goes 25 miles or so north of the Sea of Galilee. And he comes to that place, Caesarea Philippi, the place of Pan worship. And there they are. There's this place of worship. It's probably very ornate, very attractive. There's these niches in the cliff. There's these niches where you have these idols, these figurines standing there. You have people all around, depending on what time of day they happen to be there. And it might be, if it's evening, there's probably fires built. There's probably all kinds of stuff going on that we don't want to talk about. And Jesus is there, and he asks the question, who do people say that I am? Who do you say that I am? Peter responds, rightly so. You are Messiah, and you are the Son of the living God. And Jesus commends him for that. He tells him, Peter, upon this Petra, this massive stone, this cliff, this is what will be the foundation of my church. It's not Peter. He's not the foundation. What is the foundation? Well, the foundation, of course, is ultimately the Lord Jesus, of course. But I think it's that profession. What did Peter just say? You are Messiah. You are the Son of the living God. That is going to become the centerpiece of the church. Because later we have record that the Christians that were expelled out of the synagogue and those that were of Gentile descent, they were required in the different principalities wherever they lived in the Roman Empire, once a year on the Dei Roma, they were to burn incense to Caesar. They were to do that. And when they would do that, they would get a certificate saying that they had shown their loyalty to Caesar and the Roman Empire. It was more of a loyalty test than it was a religious one. And you were to required to say a particular phrase as you dropped it in, and as the officials watched you, you would drop the incense in, and you would say, Kurios Kaiser. Caesar is Lord. Christians had a very, very challenging time saying that. As a matter of fact, it was some stated that no true Christian would ever utter those words. Christians often would utter a different word. Christos is Kurios. In other words, Jesus is Lord. Christ is Lord. So what Peter says here becomes a very, very important statement.
Now, but there's more, and this is where Roman Catholicism, I think, continues to go off the rails here, literally. Because, let's pick it up in verse 19. I will give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. And then he warned the disciples that they should tell no one that he was the Christ. Okay? Now, the power of binding and loosing has become the centerpiece of Roman Catholicism. And the belief that somehow in this encounter that Jesus confers upon Peter the position of being the first pope, the authority within the church. Big C, church. Okay? And they've built their hierarchy around this understanding. So, what you end up with is
a hierarchical system, top down, where people are compelled to just fall in line, so to speak. The Pope is looked upon, whomever the Pope is, if he sits in Peter's, the vicar, he's a vicar of Rome, if he sits in Peter's chair, when he speaks, do they call it ex cathedra? That is if God himself is speaking. And that's where some of the veneration of Mary and all those kind of things that make Roman Catholics, exclusively Roman Catholics, come. And they have a very, very authoritarian, now listen to me, they have a very authoritarian structure. And if they were correct in their interpretation here, that would make sense. The problem is they're incorrect. They're incorrect. There is nothing here that would suggest that Peter somehow is given some sort of special privilege that the other disciples are excluded from. The focus is on the what Jesus is showing them there, the power of loosing. But you need to notice that it's in heaven. And what are the keys to the kingdom? Well, let me give you a couple of, I think, important factors. One, the keys to the kingdom, Acts 2. In Acts 2, what takes place there? Day of Pentecost. Who is the main speaker there? Peter. Peter becomes the main speaker to the Jewish audience that Jesus is indeed Messiah. He is Christ. He has risen from the dead and began teaching that point. A little bit later in the book of Acts, you get to chapter 10. Again, Peter is the one that's the focus here as far as the disciples are concerned. What happens? It's the Gentile Pentecost. Peter is summoned to go to a man's house named Cornelius, centurion. When he gets there, the house is filled with people that Cornelius had invited to be there to listen to Peter. Peter comes and he assures them that he should not be there as an Orthodox Jew, but nevertheless, God had compelled him to come because of the vision of the sheet coming down. And when he began speaking and preaching Christ to these people, it was obvious that, matter of fact, it was even those Jews that were with Peter said, they are experiencing the same thing that we did. When was that? Acts 2. You got the keys to the kingdom? That's the key being open. The door being open. All right? So,
and before our time gets away, we got to get to this next part. And we're not going to be able to fully develop it as we should or ought to. But I wanted to at least get to the point of introducing it. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and be raised the third day. First time, Jesus is crystal clear. It's going to be three times total. He's going to have to remind his disciples, but he's telling them. This is the first one. He tells them this very statement. Why he's going to Jerusalem. What is going to happen there? Peter, remember what Peter just did. Remember? He made a good profession, did he not? Well, Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. The nerve! He began to tell Jesus he's going to straighten Jesus out. Oh no, that's not the plan. Saying, God forbid it, Lord, this shall never happen to you. But he, Jesus, turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you are not setting your mind on God's interests, but man's. Okay, we'll probably pause right there. Peter rose to great heights and he sinks to great depths within minutes.
I need to say something else I neglected to say a moment ago about this area of Caesarea Philippi. Pan was the god that was worshipped there. He was the guardian entering into what they, this is what the Greek mythology was, entering into the place where the dead go. That, in a Jewish mind, became associated with Satan. Because Satan is the one that was able to instigate and bring into God's creation the death of humans. So when Jesus talked about this gate of Hades, he's also talking about satanic power. And that's why we have, even there, out of Peter's mouth, Satan speaking. And this isn't the first time. It's the first time that he actually says this, but Satan has already been trying to get Jesus to deviate from his course. Remember at the temptations? No. Come, worship me. I will give you all the kingdoms of the world. That's why you came, is it not? So you see that this is another attempt of the devil to get Jesus off of his mission. Off of his mission. Any thoughts or comments? I know I rattled on a lot here.
No, I've never heard it explained like that.
It's important. Details are important. And that's what we in our tradition. Why don't we have a pope? Why don't we do that? Why don't we have a denomination as a hierarchy? Are we just stubborn? Well, we are that. We are stubborn. But there's a reason why we're not. Because it's not called for in the Scripture. As a matter of fact, more clearly, when you think about it, when you move, especially Peter, same Peter calls us later a kingdom of priests and living stones that's built up into a house. You find that the idea of what we call the priesthood of the believer, which isn't taught much anymore by some groups, is such a powerful doctrine. You don't need a pope. You don't need a priest. You can have direct access to God. Why? Because he's given it to you through Christ. Thank you. We're done.
Thank you.
Tell me this. I don't need to be quiet.